breaking bottlenecks to get the aid through in the Philippines. Today, Thursday, November 14th, this is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The aid operation is ramping up, but there are still too many survivors without food and water. An official with the World Health Organization tells us why it's taking so long.
There's no electricity, there's no water, there's no nothing. Roads had to be cleared, the airport had to be cleared.
Also today, how the island nation of Palau is bracing for rising sea levels and more frequent typhoons.
People are kind of observing and they're wondering what's to blame. And so some people are looking to blame climate change, including the president.
Plus, an American dancer struggles at the Bolshoi.
It was difficult for her fitting in. She did complain about feeling like an outcast.
Now she's leaving the company and she's not going quietly.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Help has arrived, but most of it has yet to reach those who need it most. That's still the news out of the Philippines today. Much of the international aid that's pouring into the country is piling up on cargo ships and airport tarmacs, and the Philippine government continues to scramble to set up a secure distribution system. So for many survivors of Typhoon Haiyan, the wait for food, water, and medical supplies just goes on. The BBC's Jonathan Head is in the city of Tacloban.
We've seen two large Philippines naval ships come into port. The port is undamaged and quite substantial. And the reason it's not been used up to now is because the road from the port to the city center has been so covered in debris, it was simply impassable. But that's now been cleared enough for them to bring in quite substantial amounts of help. Still nothing near what's needed. There are 200,000 people here who've got nothing and had nothing for a whole week. And at the airport, the U.S. Marine Task Force that is going to be operating this massive airlift has pretty much taken over the airport there. It's, you know, the airport was very badly damaged. It's right next to the sea. It was completely swamped by the storm surge. The runway is fine, but the rest of the airport is in total ruins. And so the Marines are having to bring in all their own infrastructure, and that's what they've been doing during the day to set up the logistics and communications they need to make this airlift work. We've seen a lot of aerial activity, a lot of Seahawk helicopters, Ospreys, and C-130s coming in. And they've stressed that this is what they have to do. They've got to get the personnel in before they can start bringing in large pallets of food aid and medical aid and then start taking them out, not just to this city, but to the many areas around Tacloban that are just as hard hit. What isn't happening yet is large amounts of food going into the city. So just as we're seeing an aid operation coming in, there's increasing panic and nervousness among the people of this city. And I've spoken to many people today who've just had enough. They've been through the most ghastly ordeal. Many of them have lost large numbers of family members. And then they've been surviving, waiting for help to come, and it hasn't.
Were you able to witness any of that aid distributed to people themselves? I mean, is it actually getting to them right now?
We know that the local government has now, among the ruins of the city, managed to establish defensible distribution centers, places where the army can guard the food supplies and can organize a distribution. But there aren't very many of those places, and they need a lot more of them, and they need the roads to be clearer. There are far more police on the roads doing that, getting rid of the debris, but there's mountains of it. They've got nowhere to put it. I don't think there's any doubt that the aid that's coming in is getting out to people, but there's, you know, we saw 13 tons come off a landing craft today. That sounds like a lot. But when you've got 200,000 people to feed and to give drinks to, that's not very much at all. So only even if it's sufficiently distributed, what we've seen so far won't get to anything like enough people.
I've also been reading really disturbing reports of body removal, or rather the lack of body removal. What is the process right now when transportation isn't working, there's no water, no electricity, there's no morgue, presumably? Can they be buried in Tacloban, or is the dirt too shallow?
It's a rather crude process. They're basically mass graves in which bodies are being tipped, in many cases before they've been identified. They don't have any other way of dealing with them. They have been left out for a very long time. Now you see far more organized body collection teams going around with trucks. They do have body bags and they're picking them up. And then they've been put in mass graves. But of course, for a lot of people here, there will be a lingering trauma about not finding people who are missing, not knowing whether they went into a mass grave, they got washed out to sea. That not knowing will be very, very stressful. And I think given the fact the authorities don't seem to have any other way of dealing with it, the lack of documentation of bodies, the fact they're just dumping them in graves, will be another pain and a burden for people who've already lost a lot to bear.
The BBC's Jonathan Het in Tacloban. Philippines authorities say they're doing their best under extraordinary circumstances. The World's Leo Hornack spoke earlier with Lieutenant Colonel Ramon Zagala. He's a spokesman for the Philippines military. Zagala admitted there have been serious problems, but said aid delivery and security are slowly improving on the ground.
As the days have gone by and more Philippine National Police have been deployed and more soldiers have been deployed, they were able to stabilize the area and return law and order. However, that's not yet 100%. It's still a challenge that we get all the areas back on its normal state. And of course, we won't be able to do that right away.
Because I'm sure you're aware that there has been criticism in the Philippine media about the amount of assistance that the Philippine government and the Philippine state has offered to the survivors. Do you feel that's a fair criticism so far?
Well, we recognize that, that it is really a daunting task. This kind of tragedy has never happened before. And that we accept the criticism. Of course, we're doing our best. And we know that there are more challenges ahead. And we'd like to seek everyone's understanding and patience.
But you do accept that criticism.
Yes, we do. And we understand that people are going hungry. People are desperate. That's why it is very imperative for us to move faster. And that we are doing.
If you had a message for any survivors in the Philippines who maybe are waiting for assistance at this moment, what would that message be?
Please hang on tight. We are on our way. We know that the situation is difficult, and we will be there for you.
Lieutenant Colonel Ramon Zagala of the Philippine military. The Philippine government does have a lot to answer for when it comes to the slow pace of aid delivery, but the relief effort is huge, and it involves many other organizations as well, like the World Health Organization. I asked spokesman Gregory Hartle to explain what the WHO is doing in the Philippines.
WHO has two roles in this relief effort. First of all, it supports the Philippine Ministry of Health, it's called the Department of Health, with technical advice, with actual personnel in the operations center there. And the second role is that it coordinates on behalf of the United Nations system all incoming health-related materials, personnel, equipment, medicines, etc. So those are the two principal roles.
What are the challenges your people are facing on the ground at this point?
As everyone in the world now has seen by now with the pictures, this is an absolutely gigantic disaster. It's probably the worst typhoon ever to have hit the Philippines, if not in the world, full stop. It is basically the equivalent, because of the Philippines' geography, of 8 separate disasters, because it's affected a number of major islands in the central of the Philippines. And it means that you have to recreate an infrastructure for the reception and distribution of aid on each one of those islands, or maybe on 2 points on some of the islands.
And yet the response, even officials recognize that, has been very slow in relation to the scale of the disaster. Why is that?
Well, I'm not so sure the response has been slow in relation to the scale. Let's say, maybe the response has been the way it has been because of the scale. The scale is absolutely enormous. We know, for example, that 20 foreign medical teams have arrived in the country. And if you think about 20 field hospitals coming into a single airport at the same time, along with all the food supplies, along with all the shelter supplies, that is going to create huge bottlenecks. And these bottlenecks are starting to get unblocked. For example, we now both have hospitals set up in Cebu and in Tacloban. There are 5 now, I think 3 in Tacloban and 2 in Cebu. So things are starting to move and services are starting to be provided again. But remember, what had to happen before anything else was there's no electricity, there's no water, there's no nothing. in Tacloban, for example. And so the most basic infrastructure had to be reconstructed. Roads had to be cleared. The airport had to be cleared before anyone could land there. And then secondly, to get that help out beyond the airport meant clearing roads. So this is a monumental process.
Gregory Hartle, a spokesperson with the WHO in Geneva, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
That monumental process of getting aid to the Philippines extends to places far from the affected region, to anywhere basically where donations are being accepted or where aid workers are getting ready, like here in Boston. WGBH reporter Ibi Caputo spent some time with a group of disaster medicine doctors from Boston as they prepared to head out. She found that the logistics are overwhelming before anyone even sets foot on a plane.
Heading off to the Philippines now is kind of like going on a really intense camping trip.
But there's a few very important things. One of them is a camelback. Make sure you have that.
Dr. Gregory Ciatone directs the disaster medicine training program at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. He spoke yesterday on a conference call with four doctors who are about to leave for the Philippines. A camelback full of water is just the beginning.
Make sure you have the chlorine tablets or a microfilter. Very important. Yep. And finally, make sure you have some self-generated electricity. There's not going to be a lot of electricity there. It's going to get very, very dark at night. All right? So have some sort of self-charging, preferably, or battery-powered illumination device.
Then there are medical supplies. Each doctor has to bring his own, enough to last the first few days before reinforcements come in from a partner organization already in the Philippines. They also need to bring a tent, sleeping bag, rain gear, mosquito net, a GPS device, and dental floss, kind of like duct tape for a disaster zone. And, like a camping trip,
you should be able to keep all of your equipment in a bag that goes on your back.
Right.
You should not have any bag to carry. It should be everything in a backpack, or what I used to use is actually a military duffel bag that I carry on my back.
Right.
Yes.
Some of the doctors are worried about security in the Philippines. Ciatone tells them to stick together, and he gives them the name of a guy they can call in case of emergency.
He will drop everything and anything and come and get you immediately if you're in any kind of trouble. And he is that level of security. He's the kind of security that we use in Haiti. He's a former special operations guy, and he's tied into a huge and very robust network.
It's that type of network and networking tying the entire global response in the Philippines together. For The World, I'm Ibi Caputo in Boston.
Typhoon Haiyan also hit part of the Pacific island nation of Palau. There were no deaths, but the destruction was significant. And it's the second typhoon to hit Palau in less than a year. That's got residents thinking hard about big storms, rising sea levels, and the future.
The people of Palau really depend on the ocean. Their entire identity is woven in and around the ocean. And so that relationship is something that's historic and quite important.
How Pacific Islanders see their future, coming up later on the program. It's The World from PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association. November is Diabetes Awareness Month. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com and by Reputation.com, dedicated to helping individuals and businesses make a strong first impression on the Internet by ensuring accurate search results and authentic online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World.
My dream is to dance on the Bolshoi stage with the Bolshoi Ballet Company. I love this school, and I really want to stay here. I fit in here, and I've never fit in that way anywhere else.
That was Joy Womack in a New York Times video 3 years ago. She was just 15 at the time, and she'd just been accepted by the prestigious Bolshoi Ballet Academy in Moscow, the first American to receive the honor. Womack graduated last year, and the Bolshoi Ballet Company hired her. But this week, she quit the troupe she'd yearned to be a part of for years and accused one of its directors of extortion. Womack told a Russian newspaper that this director told her in order to get a solo role, she needed to either pay $10,000 or sleep with someone influential, also known as a sponsor. Simon Schuster is a Moscow-based reporter for Time magazine. Simon, we have not been able to get in touch with Joy, but you've talked with her several times and gotten to know her. What do you think she's going through right now?
I think this must be a terrible time for her. I just know how much she loved the company and how she always dreamed of dancing at the Bolshoi Ballet Company, which has a particular aura really around the world as a legendary company and perhaps the most storied and famous in the world.
So how did being the first American to be accepted into the Bolshoi actually affect her relationship with them?
It was difficult, I think. It was difficult for her fitting in. When we spoke during several interviews, she did complain about feeling like an outcast. And in the article that came out this week where she announced she was quitting, the author speculated that as an American, perhaps some of the more corrupt directors at the theater would have thought that she would be more able to pay this kind of extortion money. It certainly didn't make it easier for her to be an American in this distinctly Russian company.
So the Russians thought that because she was American, she would rise to the occasion and pay this bribe?
Yeah, it turned out to be the exact opposite. It seems like she was much less willing to engage in the various politics and interpersonal dramas that play out inside the theater. She tried to rise above it. We talked about that a lot. She tried to basically focus on her work and focus on her training without engaging in the politics that goes on backstage. But it seems like it eventually got to her.
So if you want a leading role, you either pay that bribe or, as she said, get a sponsor. Tell us about this sponsor system. It sounds sleazy, but it also sounds formalized. Is it formalized sleaze?
It's not a formal institution, but it is essentially part of the Bolshoi tradition going back hundreds of years. In the 19th century, essentially the Russian aristocracy, the nobility, used the Bolshoi as a place to find girlfriends or lovers. In the Soviet times, essentially the same thing went on, except it was the Communist Party bosses who were playing this role and got to go to the theater and party with the ballerinas afterwards. Now in Russia, after the fall of communism, there's essentially a new elite, an elite based on capitalism. So the billionaires and multimillionaires who have the resources to sponsor and finance the theater, they are allowed to attend these galas where allegedly directors encourage the ballerinas to develop relationships with them that are sometimes not platonic.
You're laying this out all sort of matter-of-factly. I mean, Joy Womack has made these charges. They're pretty heavy charges. What does it mean for Russians that these accusations are coming from an American and one who is so young?
The general reaction has been, well, she's just being a prima donna and trying to attract attention. Knowing Joy, that seems totally untrue. She was always very focused on her work and devoted to making sure that her career progressed according to the merits of her dancing. Since that interview was published yesterday, she has essentially refused to pick up her phone and give any more comments. So she's not vying for publicity here.
Has the Bolshoi Company responded to Joy Womack's accusations?
Yeah, yesterday they released a statement saying that essentially she should take her claims to the police rather than the media. And if the police manage to confirm what essentially are criminal charges of extortion, then the guilty parties would be punished. They have not confirmed or denied whether these practices do go on.
A former soloist at the Bolshoi is on trial for attacking the company's artistic director with acid. I think that was earlier this year. I mean, this is a lot of bad press for the Bolshoi lately. Are these things related?
In some ways, they are. It seems that the acid attack against the artistic director was linked to the kinds of favoritism that goes on there. According to the prosecutors in the court case, the alleged culprit, who is himself a star dancer and a soloist at the Bolshoi, he allegedly staged the attack in order to take revenge against the artistic director, who was supposedly stifling the career of another ballerina.
Could this pile of bad press have any impact on the Bolshoi?
It's nothing new to the theater. There have been scandals going back many generations, really, since the theater began. Many of them, you know, tend to be forgotten.
What about in Russia? Are Russians still proud of the Bolshoi, despite all this stuff?
They're extremely proud, and it's often hard to explain to Western readers the power of the Bolshoi in the Russian sense of self, sense of identity. And when these scandals break, it's very painful for a lot of the members of the public. I mean, I've had taxi drivers in Moscow complaining to me, you know, oh my God, another scandal at our beloved theater. So it's certainly not something that only affects the theatrical elite. It's really a part of the national heritage.
Sounds kind of like the NFL. They just keep taking the hits, but doesn't seem to bother anyone.
Yeah, as long as they keep dancing and they keep putting on fantastic productions. But I think they would be able to be a much better company if they could avoid these kinds of politics, these kinds of internal rivalries and scandals.
Simon Schuster with Time Magazine in Moscow, thanks for telling us all about this.
Mm-hmm, thank you.
Sweden and Switzerland, two countries with two easily distinguishable names in English, but not in Chinese. Here's the BBC's Kai Wang.
Sweden is Rydian. Swedish is Ruishi. So basically they shared one same character. The pronunciation is similar too.
So similar that staff at the Swedish consulate in Shanghai were frustrated by the number of Chinese who confuse their country with Switzerland. So they had a cartoonist come up with an image that shows what makes the two countries unique. The cartoon went up on Weibo, the Chinese Twitter, and then it went viral. Victoria Lee is a Swedish consul general in Shanghai.
It got a huge success rate. Very many people had picked this cartoon up and commented on it.
You can see the cartoon at PRI.org. All the stereotypes are on display. Sweden gets symbols like a Viking, a moose, Pippi Longstocking, and a hot blonde in a bikini. The Swiss side of the panel, you see Banks, the Alps, Fondue, and Roger Federer. Now, the Swiss and Swedish consulates in Shanghai are taking it a step further. Together, they've created an online competition. Anna Mate is the Swiss deputy consul general.
The participants have to illustrate the differences between Switzerland and Sweden in a creative and innovative way.
The contest winner gets a trip to Sweden and Switzerland and might just come back yodeling to ABBA. Knowing me, knowing you. This is The World on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, a reporter meets a woman in Palau who says she'll never leave her island nation, no matter how high the seas rise.
She told me that, you know, there's a tradition here that people don't leave their island in case of an emergency. Because if they leave their island, there's the thought that they may come back to an island that's disappeared.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at stopdiabetesnow.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. We've been focused on the ongoing disaster in the Philippines the last few days, rightly so, as Filipinos are still struggling to cope with an unprecedented crisis. But other countries in the region also suffered at least glancing blows from Typhoon Haiyan. One of them was a small Pacific island nation of Palau. The World's Ari Daniel happens to be in Palau this week, and I asked him about the damage there.
Really, the area that was hardest hit by the typhoon was the northernmost part of Palau. Palau is a collection of hundreds of islands, and the northernmost island is Kayangal, which the typhoon eye passed within about 5 miles of. And so the heaviest damage was in that area, and most of the houses there were destroyed. Roofs were blown off. There was a lot of damage in terms of trees and branches coming down. Some people evacuated before the typhoon, and everyone was cleared out after the typhoon blew through. One saving grace was that when the typhoon came, it was during low tide, and so the surge was much less than if it had been during high tide.
So has the government of Palau had to mount any sort of relief operation?
Yeah, I mean, the government has responded and other Palauans have responded, and those relief efforts are ongoing. Thankfully, nobody died, but there's a lot of infrastructure that needs to be repaired.
I gather it's pretty unusual for Palau to be hit by a storm like this. And despite the cautions of many scientists, the president of Palau is laying the blame squarely on changing conditions due to climate change. What makes it so patently clear to him?
Well, this is actually the second typhoon to come incredibly close to Palau within the last 11 months. 11 months ago, a typhoon passed actually to the south of Palau, and that also really frightened people, and now this one. And so people are kind of observing this increased frequency over the very short term, and they're wondering what's to blame. And so some people are looking to blame climate change, including the president.
And you've been talking with Palauans about climate change and their concerns about the future. What have you been hearing, and how do they see climate change there?
Well, you know, it's definitely a concern here. If sea level does rise, Palau is going to be hit pretty hard. And so climate change is a very large concern. In addition, the people of Palau really depend on the ocean. Their entire identity is woven in and around the ocean. And so that relationship is something that's historic and quite important. So when they think about climate change and sea level rise, it's definitely concerning them. You know, I've spoken with a few different people about their views. And, you know, most are concerned about sea level rise, but some say it's not as big an issue as many think. They say they'll just move to a higher part of Palau if there is an issue. I spoke with one researcher who said that even with, you know, several feet of sea level rise, still most of the islands would be fine because there's a lot of higher elevation ground. But it's people that have land and grow crops near the shore that are concerned. In speaking with one person, she told me that, you know, there's a tradition here that people don't leave their island in case of an emergency, because if they leave their island, there's the thought that they may come back to an island that's disappeared. They may not be able to return. And so there were some during this latest typhoon that didn't leave for that reason. They were going to stay no matter what. And so, and she's of that opinion too. She said that she will stay on Palau for as long as she needs to. Even if the seas rise, she said she would set up shop in a boat because she's Palauan and she plans to stay here. But there were others who said they would move, and if conditions got worse, that they would leave the country.
Ara, you're actually in Palau looking at coral. I'm just wondering, is it hard to process such an existential crisis like climate change in a place that I presume looks like paradise?
You know, I've been spending the week with researchers that are studying these corals, and one of them told me that the way the timing worked out in the weather, she didn't even miss a single day of data collection due to the typhoon. The typhoon blew through here less than a week ago, and life continues as usual. Most of Palau wasn't even affected. It's an incredibly beautiful place. The corals are just bursting with color and vitality, and so I think the only sign of a typhoon having passed through that I've seen was a lot of sediment that had gotten stirred up, and so it was harder to see down to see the coral. That was the only impediment to kind of viewing this place as a paradise. Everything else is just magnificent.
The world's Ari Daniel in the Western Pacific nation of Palau. Thanks so much for your time, Ari.
Thanks so much, Marco.
Another island that's had to deal with disaster is Hispaniola in the Caribbean. It's shared by two countries. On one side, Haiti. On the other, the Dominican Republic. Recently, on the Dominican side, the country's highest court issued a controversial ruling. It allows the Dominican government to revoke the citizenship of children born to undocumented immigrants. The decision is reverberating in the DR and Haiti and among Haitian and Dominican immigrants living in New York City. As part of our Global Nation coverage, Bruce Wallace has that story.
About a dozen Haitian pastors gathered on a recent evening in the back room of a restaurant in East Flatbush, Brooklyn. The neighborhood's a center of Haitian life in New York City. There's a lot on the agenda, but first, of course, a hymn. One of the leaders here is Bishop Emmanuel Dennis. He says as soon as he learned about the court ruling in the Dominican Republic, he started making calls.
When I heard that, I began to say, okay, as ministers, as shepherds, you know, we have to do something. We cannot stay passive. We have to take action. We have to cry against that.
He's upset about a decision in September by the Dominican Republic's Constitutional Court. It tightens a 2010 law denying citizenship to people born to parents who aren't Dominican, and makes it retroactive for anyone born after 1929. It affects about 250,000 people, most of them with roots in Haiti. International rights groups call the ruling racist. In the Dominican Republic, people are evenly split over it. And in New York, Haitian and Dominican immigrants are uniting against the ruling. The Haitian pastors are part of the protest movement, talking in Creole late into the evening, strategizing and planning marches. Some demonstrations have already begun.
Vive Haïti! Vive Haïti!
Recently, a crowd gathered in Times Square near the Dominican consulate to protest the ruling. Signs in Creole, Spanish, and English read, "Dominican Republic, stop the apartheid," and "No to ethnic cleansing." Longtime Haitian activists here are helping organize the protests, people like Lord Divers. And he says it's not common to see Haitians so united on an issue. Politics can often split the community here, with people, say, for or against former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide or the current president, Michel Martelly.
But the difference is with our group, we have all those people in one group, and all those people are fighting for only one cause, human right and human dignity.
Este es un mensaje para todos los dominicanos. Me dicen el gringo aplatanado.
New activists are stepping up too. A white Columbia University grad student who spent time in the Dominican Republic posted a YouTube message arguing against the law. The video closes with a series of young Dominicans saying, "Ese no se hace," you don't do that in Spanish.
Eso no se hace.
Eso no se hace.
The video spawned a Facebook page and a recent conference at Columbia that drew a variety of people, including many Dominican Americans. Raquel Batista, a lawyer and immigrant rights activist here, says she and other Dominican Americans have been active on this issue for a while.
There's definitely been a growing group of supporters here in the Dominican community for a very, very, very long time.
That support doesn't surprise Edward Paulino, a professor at John Jay College who focuses on Haitian-Dominican issues. He says that Dominicans here, especially undocumented immigrants, connect with Haitians who now find themselves in this legal limbo over citizenship. Paulino also knows that connections between the Dominican Republic and Haiti run deep back home. Recently, he was on the border that divides the two countries on the island of Hispaniola. Paulino said that people there told him to deliver a message to the wider world.
Tell the people out, wherever you go, that we have a history of working together. We don't like the ruling, but here, real life is about coexisting. It's really the only thing they've known for more than 200 and 300 years, and that is trading with each other and knowing each other.
The Dominican Constitutional Court has given the country's election board 1 year to review civil registries and identify people whose citizenship could be revoked under the new ruling. The old connections along the border and the newly energized activists in the U.S. are set to be tested. For The World, I'm Bruce Wallace, New York City.
Some of the people we just heard from talk about how Haitians and Dominicans have united on the citizenship issue, but there is deep-seated prejudice against Haitians in the Dominican Republic. There's even a term for it, anti-Haitianismo. For The World That Was, Chris Wolfe has been digging into the roots of this hostility. And Chris, what did you find?
Marco, it's all about race, identity, and money. Let's start with the money. The Dominican Republic is not a rich place, but it's a lot better off than its neighbor, Haiti, next door. About six times better off per capita GDP income. So a lot of Haitians are moving to Dominican Republic and have done for generations just to find work, to make a living. And some Dominicans are unhappy with that because they see Haitians as so different.
How are Haitians and Dominicans different on this single island?
Let's start with language. Most Dominicans speak Spanish as opposed to Creole based on French, which is spoken in Haiti. They're not really mutually comprehensible. And then the big issue is race. Haitians are overwhelmingly, Haiti is overwhelmingly black, whereas Dominicans generally more tend to identify with the European part of their heritage rather than the African part.
And yet most of the Dominicans I've met are black.
Yeah, DNA testing confirms it. Most Dominicans do have some African ancestry somewhere in their family tree. But race here doesn't mean the same as it does in the Dominican Republic or elsewhere in the Caribbean. There are many gradations and shades that people in the Caribbean use. They maybe describe themselves as moreno, trigueño, or blanco oscuro.
All various degrees of mixed race. So how did this all come about? What are the roots of the differences between Haitians and Dominicans?
Well, Haiti was a French colony. Dominican Republic was Spanish. Both were racially stratified and slave-based culture, but the French side was overwhelmingly plantation slavery. At the end of the colonial era, about 90% of the people in the French side are African slaves, where less than half of the population on the Spanish side are Africans in bondage.
Now, the African slaves in Haiti fought and won their freedom and independence. Famously, they were the first ones in the Western Hemisphere. What happened in the Dominican Republic?
Well, it's long, complicated, and bloody. But the key event, Dominicans will tell you, will be the long war of independence that the Dominicans fought against not the Spanish or the French, but against Haiti. It lasted more than a generation. Haiti took over the eastern half of the island in the early 19th century. And one expert was telling me today that the elite in the Dominican Republic, even today, still feel what they call this insult to having to answer to black overlords at that time in their history.
Hence anti-Haitianismo. And did anti-Haitianism ever become official policy in the Dominican Republic?
Yes, from about 1930 onwards, when the Dominican Republic was run by Rafael Trujillo, a dictator, there was an enormous stress on the European heritage rather than the African heritage, which is, you know, not surprising given the prevalence in Europe and here in the States and elsewhere for racial theories at the time. Not that it makes it any, you know, more acceptable. European immigration was encouraged. Trujillo was famously mixed race himself and used makeup to make himself appear lighter skinned in public. And then it's no laughing matter, though. This could and did turn deadly. There was periodic deportations and violence against Haitian workers, the most famous being a massacre in 1937, where about 20,000 Haitians were killed in a few days along the border area. At the same time, the government was organizing migrant workers to come in to try and make money on state-owned plantations and construction projects. So there was an organized migration in, and at the same time, there's this ambivalence. They need the cheap labor. They don't want these outsiders to become part of society.
And that's where the money comes in.
Exactly.
So does racism persist today in the Dominican Republic?
Well, it depends who you talk to. And obviously, you can't generalize for an entire population. As we were just hearing in Bruce's report, there's a lot of Haitians and Dominicans who get along just fine. But then you come to this UN report that came out in 2007. And I have to quote it. It describes what it calls a profound and entrenched problem of racism and discrimination in the Dominican society, generally affecting blacks and particularly such groups as black Dominicans, Dominicans of Haitian descent, and Haitians. And it goes on. While there is no government policy of racism and no legislation that is on the face of it clearly discriminatory, the experts highlight the discriminatory impact of certain laws, particularly those relating to migration, civil status, and citizenship. Now, of course, the government of the Dominican Republic denies it vehemently, and a lot of the Dominican elites will also like absolutely say, no, there's no racism. Like, just look at us. You know, we're a mixed-race people. So, you know, it's a question of degree.
The World's Chris Wolf, thanks for that historical backstory.
You're welcome.
If you've got a question for Chris about how history affects what's happening around the globe today, send it our way. We could end up answering it on air. Tweet us your question using the hashtag #TheWorldThatWas. You're listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Reputation.com, dedicated to helping individuals and businesses make a strong first impression on the Internet by ensuring accurate search results and authentic online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. And by Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. If you're going out on a Friday night in Lagos, Nigeria, chances are you're heading to church. All-night prayer vigils are at the core of the country's booming Pentecostal movement, and I mean booming. Some services draw worshipers in the hundreds of thousands. At one church, Friday night vigils take place in what locals call an auditorium, but basically it's a covered pavilion that's the size of 87 football fields. And as Rowan Moore Garrity reports, it's not quite big enough.
Auditoriums don't last long at the Redeemed Christian Church of God. They keep taking them down to build them back bigger. Worshippers walk past scores of vendors who've set up shop on the foundation of the church's old pavilion. It was demolished a few years back. Volunteer Wale Akande stands by the new auditorium in a fluorescent green vest, welcoming visitors to the Holy Ghost service.
Once the service starts, all these people that are selling, they close their shop to come into the auditorium to listen to the word of God.
The pavilion beside us was built in 2000 to seat a million people. It's basically a corrugated rooftop, the ground below paved with cobblestones and lined with thousands of crude wooden benches. Akande says tonight, attendance is down because of the rain. It's only a third full. Even so, he immediately asks me the same question I hear all night.
Have you heard about the new auditorium that is going to be built next? It's going to be like 18 times this size.
That's 3.5 square miles, all under one roof. Inside the current auditorium, worshippers with tambourines prepare for the vigil under stadium lights. Some pray aloud on mats stretched out on the ground. The praise doesn't let up for the next 8 hours. Most people can only see the altar on giant screens, if at all. But it hardly seems to matter.
It's really, really, really mighty.
That's university student Semi Oladepo talking about Holy Ghost Night. She tells me it's when you talk one-on-one with God and expect a miracle from Him. Other than a few children sleeping on the ground, the crowd seems intensely focused on just that. But the Redeemed Church is also focused on gaining new converts. That's part of the logic behind headline-grabbing projects like a prayer hall almost 3 times the size of Central Park. But the Redeemed Church is also focused on gaining new converts. That's part of the logic behind headline-grabbing projects like a prayer hall almost 3 times the size of Central Park. And Redeemed Camp, the church's sprawling, city-like campus. Oladepo lives here and says she seldom leaves.
We have secondary schools on camp, we have hospitals on camp, we have banks on camp, police station, we have gardens and all.
Even more important, though, is old-fashioned Christian outreach. Oladepo urged me to accept Christ before it's too late. Then, she checked on my progress a few minutes later.
Do you think you'll become a Christian soon?
Whether I do or don't, Redeem's outreach is working. American gospel singers came to perform at Holy Ghost Night this year, but increasingly, Christian evangelism is headed in the opposite direction. In June, Redeemed inaugurated another pavilion with 10,000 seats in Greenville, Texas. For The World, I'm Rowan Moore Garrity, Lagos.
Rowan Moore Garrity did his reporting in Nigeria with a grant from the International Reporting Project. Now, how about some Christian rock from Nigeria to go with that big church? Well, maybe it's not Christian rock. Maybe it's just Nigerian electronic rock. No one really seems to know. This is William Onyabor. He's from Nigeria.
We have this amazing music, but we have an artist that actually won't talk about himself.
And that's Eric Wells, the label manager for Luwaka Bop Records in New York. They wanted to put out a collection of Onyabor's electronic music 4 years ago. Wells had to find out more about this artist, who briefly in the 70s and 80s created these futuristic sounds. Onyabor never became famous, not even in Nigeria, and that made Eric Wells' research pretty hard.
Anytime I'd speak with anyone, you know, had met him before, I would be told that, you know, that's the most stupid thing I can do to try and go see him. And then you'd speak with...
Did they explain why that was a stupid idea?
He, first of all, won't want to see me. He won't want to speak to me about the things that I want to talk about. And if I thought maybe I could, like, shower him with love, you know, and tell Onyabor about all the great artists out there that admire him. But I was told then if I do that, Onyabor will break my neck and ask where the money is.
Doesn't respond well to flattery.
Right, exactly. So I understood that. I won't try that strategy.
There were no articles or reviews about Onyabor's music. Eric Wells had no formal biography to refer to. All he knew is that Onyabor became a born-again Christian when he stopped making music in the 80s.
The first time I heard the music, you know there's something special there. And then you feel like there's like a roadblock, I guess, in the beginning.
So finally, Wells did go to Enugu, Onyabor's remote hometown in Nigeria, to meet him in person. When I play my kind of music, I'm playing for your body and soul. Did he want to talk about his music? Did he want to talk about the lyrics?
Not really. I spent a week with him, and kind of the pretext of this is that any time we'd ever try to ask him anything about his music or from the past, he would completely shut off or turn silent. The only time when we touched upon his music was on the last day when I was there, and he gave me some records. Much of what we did was spend time together watching Christian television, Nigerian Christian television, this Nigerian prophet called T.B. Joshua. the town of Enugu is heavily evangelical, so everyone in this town is basically a born-again Christian. And when you go around town, if you meet someone somewhere, also most likely ask you if you've been born again.
Given how little we know about William Onyebor, what do we do with this album of amazing music without that context?
I think you should just listen and enjoy and take time to listen. I mean, you feel that there is a kind of a rigid structure in a way, but then it's incredibly free. Listen to a song like Let's Fall in Love. I used to listen to that when I was out in the West Coast driving in the desert in the spring and put that song on, and it just blew my mind every time.
The album is Who is William Onyebor? A great question with apparently few answers. But Eric Wells, thanks for telling us what you know.
Thank you so much.
Right on, right on.
The wild sounds of the reclusive William Onyebor from Nigeria. And that'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. And on Twitter at Marco Werman. The show is on Twitter at PRI The World. And we're back with you on the radio tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, by the Annenberg Foundation, and by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.